I believe an important part of being a good artist is recognizing your limits. So I can respect the pussies who pussy out of a project. I respect it when they get their people to be all like, well, such and such doesn't really get the stuff about slaves. I'm like, what is there not to get? It's slavery. And I'm not even asking you to play the slaves. You're playing the goddamn slave owner. I mean, God forbid you ask a black guy to play some football-playing, illiterate, drug addict, magical Negro, Iraq vet with PTSD who's secretly on the DL with HIV, but who's also trying to get out of a generic ghetto with his pregnant, obese girlfriend who has anger management issues from a history of sexual abuse. In fact, everybody's been sexually abused, and someone's mother has a monologue where she's snotting out of her nose and crying everywhere because she's been caught smoking crack and fired from her job as a hotel maid. I just made that up. Dibs.
The theater, the theater.
Bring out Louis!
Theater, theater. To be or not to be. Theater, theater.
Hey there, friends.
Hey.
How you doing?
Hello.
Hey.
It's good to see your faces. You look really happy.
Yes.
That's not always the case when we sign on to here. So.
No, sometimes it's like, oh my God, I need this catharsis of doing this show.
Yeah. Sometimes we have to cover something Scott's not into.
That's not true. That's true. But it's not necessarily accurate.
Like in 3 weeks when we cover Hook, the musical. That doesn't exist.
Let's write it.
Yeah. So I wanted to bring up something, though, from our last miniseries. We covered Moulin Rouge in our original movie musicals miniseries. And I just found out that the famed pop star, who I'm a fan of, JoJo, is going up as Satine on Broadway right now.
Oh, wow.
Pretty sure she just went up. Yeah. Which we sort of talked about, like, it doesn't really make sense to cast a Broadway person in the role because it's so pop rock and it's so of the now music. It's Katy Perry. So to get JoJo in there, I'm like, yes, see, this makes sense. I like it.
I agree.
I'm excited about it.
I agree. Yeah.
Is that like JoJo from Casey and JoJo of the late 90s and early 2000s?
No.
I wish. Honestly.
Wish.
Yeah. Baby.
We love Casey and JoJo. But no, this is JoJo. Also not to be confused with JoJo Siwa, because I brought up JoJo one time and in front of my students, high schoolers, and they're all like, JoJo Siwa? And I was like, who's that? And had to look it up. No, not her.
I don't know who that is.
I don't know.
It's okay. She was like a Dance Moms girl or something, and now she's like a big TikTok
something?
I don't know.
Right.
I don't
know. TikTok? All right. All things that I don't watch or have.
Things I don't engage with at all. Yeah, exactly. But also, I wanted to bring up one other thing before we get started on this amazing miniseries and introduce our guest. But Equity and the Broadway League, as of today, or the day we're recording, April 13th, have established a tentative reimagined agreement for how to change and shape conditions moving forward, especially for touring, is like the really big one.
Unified touring contract is
Unite the Road. Yes, is the movement, and we'll see if it sticks. They'll vote soon, I believe. But it's just supposed to sort of make conditions better for everybody who's touring right now. Which we have many friends who are on tours. We've had guests who are on tours. I think we have a couple guests who are on tour right now who have been on the show. So. We want best conditions for them.
Yeah.
It's no joke. Artists. Like, touring is no joke. And and to be able to eat and have a hotel to stay at, like, just little things like that, as opposed to your stinky bus, which is,
and
they think stinky buses.
Right. And we do a little bit of that, like, well, we do it for the art, you know? And I'm like, yeah, but we could also be treated like humans during it.
Right. There's a point where it's just unhealthy. And that's, you know. And
that's what your 20s are for.
Right. But even still, you shouldn't suffer.
No.
You shouldn't suffer or be in unhygienic conditions, which is really what we're talking about, these sort of basic standards.
Or disrespectful conditions, too. I think, you know, it's not always just about, like, the shittiness of the room you're staying in. Sometimes it's about how the producers are treating certain people.
Oh, sure.
And, you know,
Right.
all that kind of shit. But we still love the art form that is theater.
Yeah.
Speaking of, welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Burcham.
I'm CJ Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
That's right. And each week we get together to discuss and debate the definition of theater through various lenses. Now, we're going back to form once again. We're only doing a few of these this season, okay? Playwrights. We did three whole seasons where we just covered playwrights, and now we're kind of not doing that, but we had to do a few. So this week, we're discussing the evolution.
We can discuss, too.
I'm going to discuss all of discuss
all day long. Discuss everything.
Discuss all over the place.
All of it.
But we like to get together to discuss the evolutions of the great playwrights by taking a macro look at three of their plays. Macro means we're not digging deep into every line or anything. We're just kind of giving you a basic overview of our feelings and our opinions. If you're taking a test on it, maybe find a new podcast.
You will fail.
Yeah.
You will fail. And with this one in particular, you will fail real bad. Because we're not going to be able to get into
There's just no
the
way to get into Yeah, exactly.
Of what's going on.
But this is part one of three of our Brandon Jacobs Jenkins miniseries. Miniseries. Very excited. We'll be covering, this week we're doing An Octoroon. Next week we are doing Gloria.
Mm-hmm.
And the third week we'll be covering Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And very, very excitingly, we have a guest for each of those episodes, a different guest for each of those episodes. And
wow, that's a first.
That's a first. Yeah, I'm actually really pumped about it.
Yeah, totally.
We have one of my actual favorite people and artists on this planet, a phenomenal actor and writer.
Here.
The co-founder of the Blackboard Collective, something that I wear, I actually didn't even mean to. I have a hat right next to me of the Blackboard Collective that I wear all the time. Good merch. Solid merch.
Good merch.
She'll be performing her one-woman show in L.A. one night only.
Yeah!
April 21st at 8 p.m. It's called I Sell Windows at the Greenway Court Theater. CJ and I already have tickets. We're very excited to come see it.
Yay!
This is the incredible Casey Rogers.
Yeah! Welcome.
That was the best introduction ever. You do that everywhere I go.
I will. I can do that.
Bailey's a good hype man.
I'm a good hype man.
So cool.
Yeah.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello. I'm so happy to be here. I'm so honored to be invited.
Oh, this is such a cool thing. It's great to have you.
Casey, you and I worked together maybe 4 years ago now, right before the pandemic.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
We did a show. That was the beginning of 2020, I want to say.
Mm-hmm. It was right before.
Right.
We were able to squeeze a show in before everything got crazy.
That's right. It was called Gifted, and it was a play by Bob DeRosa, friend of the podcast. It actually just got a run at Loft Ensemble.
Yeah, I saw that.
With someone from our understudy cast was sort of producing and playing the lead, Bree Pavey. And so we went and saw it. It was a good time. But you and I became friends pretty quickly and we hit it off and started working on projects together and kicking it and getting brunch and being buds. And I've been wanting to get you on the pod for a very long time. So I'm glad we made it happen.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Yes, me too.
Yeah. Do y'all know each other? Scott, CJ, do y'all know?
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. we'd met before, yeah.
Just from the world, mm-hmm. just from the theater world.
Well, I was artistic director when we did
Gifted, right?
Too heavy, of course.
I always forget I saw you in that before I did Gifted. I actually,
it seems like two different worlds. It really does.
Yeah,
which was a marvelous play and a marvelous production. Like the four of you were awesome in it. That like. I think I saw that like three or four times. And so, and then my artistic committee had chosen Gifted, and then my term ended. So I didn't oversee it, but saw it.
Right. But you were around.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was around.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
I'm a huge fan of Casey. I've seen Casey in like 3 different things now. Ooh. And then we got to do the reading of Mothers of God together, which was a ton of fun.
Yeah.
Which I really, Bailey, I really hope you guys are still working on that. That was so much fun.
We definitely are. We've got a whole new draft all together. We're hoping to workshop it soon. We're very excited about it. It's coming along.
Yeah, cool. Cool evolution.
That's amazing.
Casey and CJ and Scott actually all have parts already. So you're no audition necessary.
That's what I love to hear.
Yeah. But all that to say, you're a phenomenal theater maker, and we love making theater with you, and we love participating in theater that you're involved in. So that's why we brought you on. But there's another big piece of this puzzle. We all saw you in the play we're talking about today.
Yeah.
What year was that?
That was 2021.
2021.
That was the summer of 2021.
That's right. I'm now putting everything together because I was like, oh, that was last year. But no, time has become
Well,
weird.
And it was fraught, too, because we were still dealing with COVID so much. Y'all had to, like, cancel stuff and reschedule stuff.
Right.
And it was outdoor.
So outdoor that I heard stories of, like, possums walking across the stage.
I was at that show. It was there like, was... it stopped the show for 5 minutes. It was hilarious.
Casey, what happened? Yeah. What happened that night?
I was never on stage when the exciting, crazy things happen, which many exciting, crazy things happen when, like, a theater decides to make their parking lot where they usually keep their dumpsters, like, the full stage. Like, honestly, we moved into the possum's house, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Y'all doing shows here?
And there was also like there's a car repair lot like on the back, so like oftentimes you just hear like loud like somebody like sawing car parts. It's just it was a good time, but there was a possum that just decided that it was time for them to perform, and so it was when Matthew Hancock and Rob Nagel were on stage, I think, and the possum just runs to the front of the stage, and Matthew just freezes.
What do you do?
Anything. Like, he just, like, didn't know what to do. And the audience is, like, kind of, like, nervously giggling, and everyone's kind of, like, on a standoff with this possum. And CJ, I think the possum just, like, eventually ran away, right?
Well, what I remember was, he stopped for a second, and I was sitting far back enough that I couldn't see that there was a possum. And then he was like, this has never happened before. And I was like, wait, what? Is this part of the show? And then the possum actually, it entered house left, and then it took the long cross all the way to the other side and then crossed all the way back to exit. So it was great. it just kept looking at the audience and was like, oh, there's still people here, and kept running. It was funny.
Because, like, how do you riff? How would you riff in the middle of an octoroon and do that? Like, it's like you can't digress at all.
It's nearly impossible. And Rob Nagel is a master. He improvised our way through the craziest things during that show. There was a fire, a massive fire that happened that our audience was never aware of. It was big enough to where we could see like flames and smoke. And we were like,
okay.
Eventually, but the audience was so locked in with us, and it was behind them.
Oh my God.
So
yeah.
We could see it, but they couldn't.
Holy shit.
And we were like, at what point do we stop the show?
Yeah.
Was it just a house that was on fire?
It was an apartment building that was like a block that way. So luckily it was far enough away that we didn't have to evacuate, but I was on stage. It was the beginning of the second act, and I was on stage, and so I was able to go back and be like, hey, you guys, there's going to be a lot of fire trucks, because sound bleed.
Yeah.
Sure,
you know,
sure.
Like, so we were going to have to be screaming over fire trucks for the rest of the second half, so I just warned everybody, like, I think it's okay, but we're going to have some screaming to do in about 5 to 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
Wow. Well, we'll get into more a little bit about your production. I have a couple questions about it. Since we all saw it, I just want to get here a little bit.
Yeah.
Before we actually start talking about the play in Octoroon, I would love to know a little bit more about this playwright in a little segment we like to call
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia.
Scottpedia. We love it.
It's interesting because as I did my research, there's not a lot of personal stuff about this. He's kept his profile very professional and So it's interesting. Anyway, Brandon Jacobs Jenkins was born in Washington, D.C. on December 29th, 1984.
I just have to say this real quick while we're before you get too deep into it. Every time I say his name to somebody who's not in theater circles, they go, John Jacob Jingle Smith? Like, they like can't comprehend his name, and it's such a good name. Jacobs Jenkins.
Well, my life Jenkins is... You have to take your time saying it, too.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, I like that. His name is my name, too. Okay, yeah.
He graduated high school as valedictorian and went on to study anthropology at Princeton University, from which he graduated in 2006. It makes total sense. And as his stuff gets layered, you'll see. In 2007, he earned a master's in performance studies from NYU. Again, another interesting thing. It's not theater, it's performance studies. That same year, he started work at the New Yorker's fiction department as an editorial assistant. The kid's like 22 at this point, working at the New Yorker. Like, he's a badass. It was during this time he wrote his first play, Neighbors, which is a very cool, interesting play. Right. In 2010, he quit his job and moved to Berlin through the Fulbright Fellowship program. The dude's got a lot of fellowships.
Yeah.
A lot of fellowships. a lot of grants, a lot of fellowships, a lot of awards. While in Germany, and this makes perfect sense, he wrote his next plays in Octoroon and Appropriate, when you think about the Brechtian influence on stuff. Mm. He also started Gloria while living in Berlin. Jacobs Jenkins.
I didn't even put that together. Of course. Of course he's writing Brecht. Okay, go ahead.
Everything makes sense, and then you start, like, all these little pieces start coming together.
Yeah.
Jacobs Jenkins returned to the U.S. in 2012 to study at Juilliard's Playwrights Program. During this time, he was also at NYU as an adjunct professor, Baryshnikov Arts Center, where he had a residency. Signature Theater's residency program is where he also spent some time. He had a playwriting residency there, as well as various teaching positions at Princeton. And most recently, in 2016, he was named a MacArthur Fellow.
What year was he born?
1984.
He's
right, the same age as me.
Fuck this
I'm
guy.
Too old, in other words. Well, yeah.
And he's also on the, he's also even more recently been appointed to the faculty at University of Texas at Austin, which is
sick.
A really great theater program.
And great program.
Big money there, too. So I bet you we'll see more and more of his
stuff
maybe come out of there.
Damn.
But yeah. But like I said, it was interesting. Like, I think he's distinctly really tried to keep his personal life personal. So, like, even, like, whether he's married or with somebody or has kids or anything like that, is I couldn't find anything, and I went digging.
I would venture to say, I after having read an Octoroon now and half of Gloria, I feel like he injects some of his unless he's completely making it up. I feel like he injects quite a bit of his personal life into his works.
Right. Mm-hmm. I absolutely, and I think that so much of his work is about identity. Both as a black man in America, but also as a black man in academia, and also as a black man in theater. Like, all of those things are big things to explore. And yeah, you can totally see it. And in Neighbors, which is his first show, which is the only other one I've seen a production of other than an Octoroon. And it's fascinating. It's a little clumsy. You can see that it's a first play, but it's still clearly brilliant as well. Mm-hmm. But he's dealing with that. Really, it's really evident that it's a character who's sort of struggling with their identity and their place because of their race and because of what their profession is and all that stuff. So, yeah. Interesting, fascinating man.
Oh, though. Neighbors is the only one that I don't think I've seen or read of his plays, aside from the new one that I think Steppenwolf just announced that they're doing his new play, Purpose.
Correct.
Ooh. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Is Neighbors done often? I don't know seen a... Oh, okay.
I saw it here in L.A. I can't remember
which Leith
theater.
Burke was... I think it was The Matrix.
Yes, you are
Leith
correct.
Leith Burke, one of my absolute favorite actors that I have worked... He's so talented. He was in it. And it was before I knew him, and I was so mad.
It was an amazing cast. And it's... I mean, you know, Octoroon has some... insanely profound moments, especially that end image. But Neighbors kind of like, he starts punching you early in terms of like tough stuff that you're going to deal with, and you're dealing with it for a long time.
And Octoroon similarly does that.
Oh my God. Yeah.
I feel like, yes. Glory inappropriate kind of wait a little bit. But
Yeah. Well, speaking of an Octoroon, that's what we're talking about today. An Octoroon, which is a play, obviously, written by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. It's an adaptation of another play called The Octoroon. Mm-hmm. Not an Octoroon, but the Octoroon.
The one.
By Dion Boucicault, is how you say it. But his name is Dion. But it's Dionysus. That's pretty fucking sick.
Right?
The god of wine and theater. And beehives.
Right?
Yes.
True. But also probably a racist.
Probably.
Probably, I mean, abso-frickin-lutely.
And it was 1859
is what 59. I just saw.
Okay.
59. And it's a reframing sort of thing of that. But before we get too deep into it, CJ, can you tell us what this is about, but in your own words?
I would love to.
CJ's breakdown.
An adaptation of an 1859 play, The Octoroon, which premiered in 1859. Good, CJ. Reframed using its
own words.
In her own words.
I was scribbling notes because I thought everything I wrote down was stupid. Adaptation of The Octoroon, which premiered in 1859, reframed using its original characters and plot and much of the original dialogue, centered around Zoe, a young woman who is an Octoroon, a 1/8 African-American, and two white male characters who fight to control the Louisiana plantation on which she lives, and thus either freeing her or permanently enslaving her. Throw in some Brecht, and you've got BJJs and Octoroon.
Sure. I'll take
sure.
it. Yeah. Premiered at the Soho Rep in New York. New York.
Yeah.
It's melodrama. It's a satire. It's all of the above.
It's so much stuff. There's metaphysics. Never mind metaphysics and layers. It's almost like
here.
Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
Sure.
As a play, like, and we'll get more into it. But it's a brilliant tightrope walk of theater theory, drama that has an insane impact. Like it might be a masterpiece. I think we might view it as a masterpiece.
The New York
Times
in 2018 named it the number two most influential play of all time.
Yep.
What year was that?
2018.
Okay.
After only put Top Dog Underdog above it, I think.
Correct.
Wow.
Really?
Which is a phenomenal Susan Laurie Parks play.
Yeah.
SLP. Yeah.
We all love it.
Incredible play. You guys, I need to probably listen to it. Have you done an episode on it?
We have.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm smart enough for the end of that play. Like, I love the journey so much.
You are not
alone. I don't
know
that we are.
And then at the end, I'm like, wow, I feel like this means something. I don't know what it is. Yeah.
It's funny you say that, because one of the parts of the, I read Ben Brantley from the New York Times review of this original production. And one of the things that he said he's juggling with, and I think Susan Laurie Parks is juggling with that same thing, is that he says something to the effect of, we don't have a vocabulary to talk about race. That there's something in a collective American consciousness that doesn't, we can talk about it intellectually, but there's a break in communication somewhere about that conversation, and an uncertainty about that conversation. And as I was reading that, I was thinking about Top Dog Underdog, and I'm like, because I don't know that ending either. You ain't alone, Casey. Yeah. I know I'm walking out affected. But so I think that there's a complexity there, and an uncertainty and a vagueness that they both want to leave us with a little bit.
No, definitely an Octoruna similar in its ending. I think I think it's a little less, I don't know what this means, but it's a little more like, how am I supposed to feel?
I mean,
I believe our guest for that episode is Casper. Casper had a much SLP's Top Dog Underdog. I am pretty sure Casper had I'm 100% sure Casper had a better grasp on it than all of us did. But I think Casper gets into the ending a little bit, and I can't remember fully, but you'll have to check it out. To it. It's been a minute. It's been a year.
It's been a minute.
Casper dearly, so I will definitely give it a listen.
Casper just booked something huge that I don't even know if we can say yet. Can we say it?
Yeah, it's out on social media. They put it on Facebook.
Okay, then we can say it. Casper booked Transparent the Musical.
The musical at the Taper.
At the Taper.
Yeah.
Huge. Yes. So dope. We know. And also just always booking great stuff. But we love Casper. We stan a legend.
Also all with that... Pat Town. I think Pat Town's in that cast.
Oh, Pat Town's in it too.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, look. I saw. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I'm more excited about Casper, but Pat Town also.
Totally.
we love our friends.
But Pat was tight with the creator back in the day. He's known them for a long time. So,
cool. Of Transparent specifically.
Yes. Yeah. So very really cool. Excited. Awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. Can't wait to see it.
Yeah. That'll be fun. But, why do we get up on
I was like, do you want to talk about an Octoroon?
Yeah.
Let's talk about SLP.
Let's talk about Susan Laurie Parks for a minute. No. Or let's just talk about Casper. Let's do an hour on Casper. So an Octoroon. I think it's really easy. This is one of those pieces that I think it'd be really easy for someone who's not theater-minded to go in and walk out and be like, what the actual fuck
did I just watch? It's theater for theater people, for sure, I think.
Oh, absolutely. We had people walk out of the show after the first half, or just during it every night.
Because I think we should mention to anyone that doesn't know the show, there's actors putting on blackface and redface and
that's where we're headed. So it's in the script it says that all of the male presenting performers are the ones who are, or the male characters are the ones who are cast racially incorrect, right?
Yes, that is how it's written in the production that I was in. One of them was played by a woman, and she was dope. But
I remember that. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yes, that is how he wrote it.
That's how he wrote it, and it's you know, it's kind of him, dealing with the fact that he's like, well, I don't want to cast white actors in this thing that I'm making, and it kind of started out as this discussion with his therapist about his own depression and his playwriting, and he was like, I just need some inspiration. I need something to go on. And he was like, well, just like write as yourself. Like, and just like your frustrations with theater, write that. And he was like, word, yeah, okay. And did it. And this is the product. So you have the playwright, quote unquote, or BJJ is actually I think what he's called in the thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So he has put himself fully in the play. David Henry Hwang did this in a play. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Oh,
was it? It wasn't Golden Child.
Was it Yellowface?
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Where he's like, no, this is me. I'm not going to try and code this. This is me. You're watching me.
So brave,
right?
Yeah.
And he plays two people within the show besides the sort of narrator of everything. And it's George, the white heir to the plantation. And then McCloskey.
The old overseer.
And that's the overseer. And he's in whiteface.
Yeah.
The whole show. So I could see an audience member who doesn't know what they're seeing. And there's people in blackface. There's people in,
the people in black and red face are probably the most upsetting to people.
Sure. And I wonder what kind of people were walking out.
All sorts, to be honest. Huh. Older white people a lot. Yeah. But also like a decent amount of black people were super upset about it.
Yeah.
Even a lot of black theater makers, which was super interesting for us to deal with as a cast of mostly black people.
Yeah.
And also for me personally, it was like, man, that's good theater.
Right.
Like,
if people are walking out.
If people are walking out because they're upset, like, then you've done your job.
Then like, we did it. That's what this show is supposed to do. Like, it's not like he put people up there in blackface, redface, and whiteface to be like, let's all have a good time at the theater where nobody's offended. Right. You know, like, that's not what he's doing with this play. That's and I think that that's a part of the brilliance of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
It is. It's not confrontational, but it is very Brechtian. It is the idea that we're going to get in people's faces.
A hammer. It's a hammer.
We're going to talk right to them and right at them, and eventually going to make them deal with something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was lucky that last year I was able to see Tambo and Bones at the Kirk Douglas.
Which had our friend Tim Kopax in it.
Yeah.
And yes, and it also had a guy that was a year behind me in conservatory. Trey Davis was one of the leads. And when I heard that he was in it, I was following the playwright Taylor Reynolds on Twitter. And when it was back in New York, he wrote like, guys, we just had a preview of the show and an old white guy just screamed out of the theater, walked out, picked up a planter, threw it in the middle of the street, and stomped away.
We have succeeded.
Yeah, and I just commented on it, and I was like, "Sounds like you're doing it right. Congratulations."
It's the movie Bamboozled, right?
Yeah.
It's the Spike Lee movie where it's like, okay, are you really offended by this? Are you actually, do you think you should be offended by
this? Are you feeling convicted by this? Because that's probably what it is.
Is it a mirror in front of your face?
I think it's a few things in a row, right? Because when we opened the show, Bailey, you were just touching on this a little bit. I think you said it's because he didn't want white people in the show, but really, like, his monologue says that he had white people in his show
and they
all
kept quitting.
You're
right.
Because they
forgot that completely.
They refused to play that they found the characters offensive. And he's
That's
like,
right.
Oh, really? Like, yeah. How many? Like, he's like, I'm not asking you to play the slave. You're playing the slave owner. And God forbid, like, any black person be asked to play some gangster cracked out.
Those are
literally all the stereotypes that you see black people have to play over and over and over and over again while he's putting on whiteface because all the white people have quit.
Right.
And the perfect example. Example of that in the script is you have the playwright. So you have BJJ, and he's BJJ. Then you have playwright is his name, which is a characterization of
Dion.
And this person plays an auctioneer named Lafouche.
Uh huh.
And also, and this one was tough. Wenoti, an Indian of ambiguous background, friends with Paul, whatever that means. In your production,
friends with Paul, who is a little slave boy.
Correct.
Yeah. Right.
Who is meant to be played by someone of, I believe, Asian or
Native
American descent.
Well, are you saying what the real race of the actor is or what
the real race of the actor?
Yeah, either
Paul,
Asian
not
or
the player. Yeah.
Yeah, either Asian or Latino. And ours was Asian.
And there was a scene, I don't remember if this is in the script, but there was a scene in your production where these two characters came out and put their makeup on in front of us together. And that was sort of one of the most striking images of the whole play, was just like one with half of the red on their face and one with half black on their face. And you were just like, whoo, we're about to get into some real shit, right?
Yeah.
It's also turning the ridge around on its head, too, because undoubtedly that was a bunch of white people putting on black and red face anyway, right?
Of course.
Yeah. Yeah.
Correct, which is sort
of... Hi, my name's Captain Obvious.
No, but that's, I mean, that should be said. I think that's part of the brilliance of what he does is that he takes these things that were so normalized in the original and all done by all white people, and then he puts people of color in there, and then he changes their color. You know, like, it like flips everything. You're like, what am I supposed to be offended about? Like, is this okay? Right. Are my laughs okay? Is anything okay that I do in this space?
Right. And he does this... Oh, no, I was just going to say, he does this cool thing, too, in he creates a list, a preference level when he lists out the characters and what they could or what he would prefer them to be and in what order he does. So each show can take on a really different identity. There was issues, or not issues, but there was controversy around your production, wasn't there, Casey?
Yes.
In terms of the casting?
Yes, there absolutely was. Which it was one of the options of casting, that the person who plays the Octoroon can be biracial or, you know, like partially or just white or just, you know, white presenting, because the whole thing about an Octoroon is like you're 1/8 black.
Yeah.
Right. And the rest is white, and so a lot of the times you just look white, and it's a part of the story, is that, you know, neither George nor McCloskey, I mean McCloskey learns, but George doesn't know that she's black, and he falls in love with her, and that's like the whole, so it's very important that this person is white presenting, and but obviously the lines, because many of the lines are taken from the original, she's saying horrible things about being black, and calling it like a stain, and like, how could he love such a wretched disgust, you know, like whatever. And so, obviously it's a very sensitive thing for a black audience to come and see a white woman say these things. And I will, you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion. And again, I think that's the brilliance of this show.
Yeah.
But for me, I was like, oh, that's so good. Like that's because
for sure.
It's absurd. Like, I think it actually heightens the absurdity of this original text, that this was really somebody who was supposed to be saying this about themselves.
He all but introduces that to us. He says, this is an old text. I'm fucking with it.
Right.
You're going to have feelings about it. Here we go. And he tells us right up front.
I definitely wrote down, almost exciting as the show and its idea was all the talk that sprung up around it, because I had many, I saw it late in the game. I saw it in September. I think y'all were closing in like 2 weeks, but the talk that I had heard before then, and of course the other part of it, I mean, it was theater in and of itself. The people that wanted to complain about it, I'm like, well, have you seen it? And they were like, no.
Right. There's a lot of that.
I'm gonna go see it.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that.
You said the word absurd, Casey, and that's another element that he sort of pulls from, like, we talked about Brecht, we talked about metaphysics, the melodrama of the original play, but then the absurdity of the melodrama now, and he somehow ratchets that up just a little bit too, so that it keeps you as an audience member off balance, so that you're constantly aware and you're constantly processing. There was very little time to sort of sit back and zone out. You know how often you can just zone out in a play. He doesn't let you do that.
Right.
It's really cool.
Because every scene sort of has its own bent. Like, you're not ever just sitting watching two people talk. There's something behind it.
Right.
Yeah.
Pushing it, that's like, ooh, this is tough, you know?
And down is up and up is down. Like, that's the thing, is like, for me, I'm like, if you're mad that the Octoroon isn't black, are you mad that the person wearing blackface isn't black? Are you mad that the person wearing red face, you know, isn't Native American? Like, it's doing that all the time.
Right. Yeah. And what Brandon is playing with is, what is melodrama? Melodrama is all about the binary. It's all about opposites.
Yes.
There is good.
Yes.
There is bad. There's no gray area. This is a Peter Brooks thing, actually. We talk about Peter Brooks all the time.
We do.
On this pod. And he just passed recently, too. This is why he comes up a lot. But, you know, his whole thing is like, where there is good, there is bad, there is no gray area, which what I just said. But he takes that and then now is both doing that, but also fudging with it and creating gray areas.
Right. He's like, and it's like he's infusing it into these spaces, like where it is black and white. He's infusing this nuance and this gray that makes you go, oh. It's really fucking, like I said at the beginning, I just think it's a tightrope. And I've often on this podcast been critical of academia and theater and how I feel it sometimes it makes it a little bit more elite and a little less. But he's doing that. He's avoiding all of that. There is, like, you could drop, you don't have to be a theater person. I think a non-theater person would be really shaken up by this.
Yeah.
And a theater person is going, I mean, at least I was like, how in the hell do you do this? Like, how do you break this down? And just stylistically, the cast has to also go back and forth. There's very presentational, it's very melodramatic, and then there's realism, and there's yeah. the rail of it, as I like to say.
Yeah, which is something also that's super brilliant that he does in the changing of styles that you're talking about. So a lot of the scenes that my character has,
those are my favorite scenes to read, but also to watch too.
But y'all were hilarious.
Yeah, yeah. You were y'all were fucking hilarious.
They were so fun, and it is kind of this, you do super enjoy them, but it is this commentary on Black women as entertainment, and like them finding joy in suffering and us expecting that of them, and oh, is how fun these scenes are. This is my comedic relief, these two female slaves who are in constant, if you're really listening to what they're talking about, oftentimes it's kidnapping, it's rape, it's being sold, but ha ha ha, how funny, you know, because of the way it's written and the way it's presented. And then one of my favorite parts is that you get this super funny scene between Minnie and Dido about the baby switching or whatever. And then you get this really funny, awkward thing between her accidentally walking in on McCloskey. And you've been laughing so much. And then he comes in and he slaps the shit out of her and calls her the N-word. And suddenly you're like, oh shit.
Yeah, gut punch.
Wait, maybe this isn't, like, you just don't know how to feel. And I think that gives you, he like thrusts you into the reality
it's
of what
tug
he's
of
saying.
War. It's tug of war with your stomach. It's like, it's just like, oh, but I feel kind of nice. No, I don't at all.
I would also venture to say too, that those scenes were the ones where you got the most truth out of what was going on in the show at that time, even though it was presented in this very modern day language. Mm-hmm. But they're the ones that, I don't know, like you got the truth of the situation out of it more, as opposed to the melodramatic bullshit that went on in the other scenes. And I guess you got a lot of truth when the playwright is sitting there talking straight to the audience as well.
Yeah.
But yeah.
The last thing I really wanted to make sure we talked about is the character or the representation of Br'er Rabbit.
Oh, I wanted to talk about that too.
In this play.
Or more hear what y'all had to say about it.
Yeah, I would love to hear what y'all are thinking, because it's so interesting. I remember when I saw it, I didn't fully get it, except that I was like, oh, I know that that's a racist thing. From Disney. Yeah. Like, that was my first thought.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's not just that. After reading it, I was like, oh, I should know more about what is this? And I looked it up. So
there's a whole,
I'm an
whole
asshole.
History.
Yeah. it's a big oral tradition of especially African-American enslaved, but also Caribbean, Afro-Bahamian, that kind of area. It's Brother Rabbit. He's this trickster. Playing, you know, using his wits to get it over on the different farmers or like whatever it may be. It's kind of like our Peter Rabbit or whatever.
Mm.
But when Disney makes Song of the South in the 40s, that's where it becomes the thing that everybody just knows it as.
Sure.
And it was just bastardized.
Aw, Disney.
Well, yeah, as they are wont to do.
Well, as he was wont to do. I mean, that was Walt. That was Walt.
Yeah,
that's true. That's true.
I had a quick question for Casey. Unless we're all, are we done talking about the rabbit?
I don't know. What do you got?
No,
I just wanted to bring it up.
No, thank you. Did you as a cast, in terms of preparation, did you spend much time with the Octoroon? Did you read through it at all? Did you? How did you deal with it?
As a cast, we talked about it at length. We had a dramaturg that was with us doing table work who would constantly bring it up or drop in and be like, hey, at this point, we should make sure that we know this. And there was always a copy of the OG script available at rehearsal. Okay. So on breaks, oftentimes, we would just go and like flip through and like see, like, what was this scene like originally?
Cool.
We did a lot of work with the original.
That's so cool. It's just a cool element of the theater nerd in me is like, oh yeah, you
was it just dry and boring as fuck?
Oh god, it's like impossible.
It's
to get
awful
through.
It's awful. I was sat down.
I have not read it cover to cover. I tried and I was like, I can't, I don't want to.
I went and found it last week right as I finished the rereading of this of An Octoroon, and I was like, all right, let's this will be interesting. Nope,
it's not.
Like, I was like, oh, gonna be skimming this one, like, just sort of. Yeah, and that's what I kind of what I did. I kind of like flipped through and tried to find specific scenes or moments that I wanted to compare and contrast. But
right.
It's kind of the best thing you can do with that one.
Yeah, we don't need to keep that around so much.
No.
Some things can just go away. It's fine.
Yeah, I think it's good.
Casey, did you have... I want to throw it to you about your production specifically. Is there anything else you wanted to say about that? And I think we should shout out the director.
Yes.
Judith
Moreland.
Yes.
Judith Moreland. And yeah, big shout out to her for even wanting to... It was a dream of hers to direct this play, which I think... Mm-hmm. You got to be a ballsy director to be like, no, yeah, I want to do this one.
Oh, yeah. It's hard.
Yeah.
And a ballsy theater company, Fountain. I want to give shout out to Fountain Theater.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was the first and only show I've seen there, and now I want to see more, but I was like...
They do great work.
They're doing An Octoroon, and I had just heard about it through the grapevine of theater, right, where you're just like, oh, they're doing... Okay.
Yeah.
I guess we got to go, right?
Yeah, everybody was very bold and brave, especially with that being one of the first plays back after the pandemic. So we knew that there was going to be a pretty – we had big audiences because there was nothing else on stage and we hadn't all –
nobody had been to the
theater.
It was the first thing going on in a while.
Yeah, nobody had been to the theater in at least a year. So, it was a huge, huge deal, especially in my cast in particular –
friend of the pod, Vanessa Stewart was also in those.
Oh my god, yep. National treasure Vanessa Stewart. She was fantastic in it as well. What did you ask me? What am I answering?
Just if you had anything else about specifically about your show or Judith and her work.
Judith is a badass and she was great. Also, big shout out to Annie. I'm trying to remember Annie's last name, but she was the choreographer who did the dance sequence for the auction, which so much fun, in the worst way. I don't think that there's anything else in particular that I would like to say about my production other than just it was very, very interesting to be actors on stage again after so long, in such a controversial play.
Yeah. What a return.
That was really interesting. So we are all like family for sure.
You were in the trenches together.
Yeah, we were, because we were like from like getting praised to getting ripped apart. Was a very pointed rip apart, and you just kind of had to like have tough skin and know like, hey, you read the play before you did it. You knew some people were gonna have
I don't want to put you on the spot, but everybody can answer this if anybody feels like
you
they
put
really,
me on the spot.
Really get it. Like, I think if you had to distill what this play is about, like in one, like thematically, what would be your first thought? Because it's about a lot of things. But like if someone was like, give me your elevator theme pitch of this thing.
Whatever the opposite of that stupid phrase, I don't see color, is. It's that.
Yeah.
It's that 100%. Because it's doing that in everything. I think one of the most brilliant things, too, is toward the end when Wanoti drags McCloskey off by the neck. He's, lynching him.
Yeah.
What the scene is a Native American man lynching a white man, which feels different if you were to see those actual races doing that. But what you still see, regardless of the man that's painted in a red face and regardless of the man that's painted in a white face, you see a white man lynching a black man.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it affects you differently.
That was something that I
think that's exactly right, Casey. Yeah.
And it's so smart. It's so smart because even in that, it makes you question, like, God, would I feel better if it was a white man? Yes. That's not good either. Like, that, that's bad. Like, nobody can feel good in that situation. And you also just can't, you just can't erase it, you know? Like, it's just there. It's imbued in our culture. And I think he does it in such a smart way all over this play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We covered Brecht. We did three whole episodes on Brecht. And our sort of take at the end was, or my, excuse me, I don't want to speak for anybody else. My sort of the take at the end is that, like, Brecht at the time, I'm sure, was doing some really amazing things in terms of class, in terms of social structure, all these kind of things, right? But now reading it, I don't get a lot from the direct address. I don't get a lot from the sort of like hammer it in. I feel very differently, though, about this work. And maybe it's just because it's modern and it's American and it's all these things. But also, I think this is one of those quote unquote social issues that we do kind of need to be hammering nails into people's heads to, for them to even like see it on the most basic two-dimensional level. And maybe that's what Brecht was doing, and it has made me reconsider Brecht only slightly, but not completely.
No.
But BJJ does
Travis, better. Did you hear that, Travis?
Travis. Only barely, only
No, 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 that's not true. You and I both felt very similarly about Brecht.
I can't wait for you guys to do an adaptation of The Mother and have me play The Mother. Anyway,
Sure. Bailey's going to play the mother.
I'm
all right, fine, whatever. The little bit of reading I did too about just like how it was received and stuff was he was trying to say something about like stop saying that that it's a social issue that needs to be fixed. It's not a social issue. It's something that's like ingrained into our culture. Sorry, Bailey, I wasn't saying that against
you. No, you're right.
Said.
And sort of him, all of his works kind of circle this. And it's almost even like, can we even, are social issues even something to be solved? That's a direct quote of his, right?
That's, like, that's what I read. Yeah, you're right.
Is it something
that's
to be solved, or is it something that exists that we have to
stop making it a cute thing and, that we can like work our way out of? It's ingrained.
This
and it's...
play will solve it all. If enough people see this play, like it's, that's the problem that he's wrestling with, is like, well, I know that this play isn't going to change anything. But it might make somebody walk out pissed off, and it might make them think fucking twice about
this
thing.
And that kind of theater gives me a hard-on. So.
Yeah, we have hard-ons right now. Can you see us? They're all huge.
The other thing I think that is the great accomplishment here is that it works on a macro and micro level.
Macro in means that, big.
Macro means big. Macro means small. But that it is a play about the conversation about race, and it is filtered through him as an individual. So you have this chance. I said earlier that I thought a lot of his work was about identity and where, and he's figuring out where he fits in and what his identity is in theater society, academia, etc. But I think that the great accomplishment of this is that it makes the audience member think on those two levels too. How am I related to this bigger thing? Is there anything I can do about this bigger thing? Yes, you can do your self work to do something to improve or change this.
Yeah.
Aware of it. And I think that that's something that it does brilliantly is like I think you have to question every single laugh, every single uncomfortable feeling, every single everything that comes into your body when you see this play. And if you're willing to investigate it, you'll probably learn something about your own prejudice.
Well, that's the last thing I want to say about your production is that when we went and saw it, I remember every time somebody would laugh at certain things, you'd be like, did they not get that?
Yeah. What kind of laugh is, oh my God, that was the most fun thing. I would tell people, like, if you want to see it twice, sit in the front one time and sit in the very back the next time.
And just watch the audience.
Because the audience is a show of its own. Mm-hmm. Like, the people who would be laughing, who you knew got it, and then hear a wrong laugh, and then you see them go, And like immediately like halt, like, and just be like, wait, I'm not the same as that, but we're not doing the same thing.
It does this brilliant thing that you're alluding to, Casey, that it sets up things like jokes that actually are really fucked up and offensive, but they set them up like, dun-dun-dun, like, you know, and there should be like a drum after each one of them, because the audience... We, especially non-theater people, I would say, we have sort of learned how to watch theater based, all people, even theater people. We go and we watch it, and it's like, this is how a joke is set up. This is how a laugh moment happens. And he does those to us. And some of us sometimes just are watching a show, and you give into that rhythm, and you're just gonna laugh because, and then you go, "Oh fuck, what did I just laugh at?" That's what you're alluding to. And I love it. It's so good. Okay. Well, we have two whole more episodes to talk about BJJ. But Casey, I want to give you sort of a final word on him as a playwright, but also this play.
God, he's one of the. I think he's one of the most smartest living playwrights around. The only piece of his work that I've not seen is Neighbors, and I've heard amazing things about that too. I also wanted to say earlier, when you were talking about Br'er Rabbit, I do think it's really interesting that in the original production, he, in addition to playing BJJ, played Br'er Rabbit,
right?
Also putting himself, which is commentary on it, like everything he does is just so smart. Like putting himself in the place of being the trickster. As the actual playwright,
very much what he is.
Is so fun, because I do feel like he's like really like poking you in the audience, and Br'er Rabbit does get to come out and be this like really funny. I know in our production, like, it was like this weird comic relief that would try to get the audience involved a little bit, to be like, everything's okay, like, and in this very trickstery, puppet mastery type of way. And so I think productions that can, which, again, I don't know how he did that. We considered having Matthew do it in our production, like Judith did. And then she was like, no, that's nuts. Like, I don't know how he, because that character is already doing so much. I mean, he's doing BJJ, George, and McCloskey.
They might have just had something they threw over him.
Like,
you know what I mean? Like a big mascot. Just a hat.
Doing, I mean, God, it is like a tour de force performance. And big shout out to Matthew Hancock, because watching him work.
Yes.
He was incredible.
Amazing.
Was one of the greatest pleasures of my theater career. Like, just watching him craft that, all those characters. Anyway.
That whole cast was incredible. You were absolutely a standout. Fun and so funny. The woman who played Zoe was really fantastic too, and Paul, they were all, I mean, just everyone. Thinking back on it, it was really, really good. Good times. CJ, Scott, you guys got anything else before we close it out here?
No, I think we've covered it all.
We got a couple more.
We've used the word brilliant a lot, all four of us. I think that's, you know, I'm going to be really interested to see this play done in 10 years with 25-year-olds right out of grad school or something putting it together. I really want to see how this play ages, and because it's going to be around for a while.
People, I think so too.
I would like to see another production of the play. I've technically never really gotten to see it.
You've never seen it.
And I would imagine they all feel very different. You know? Just the cast, which is an honor as an actor, but the cast is so important in this one that it's gonna feel
I feel like
crazy different.
Every cast would bring something so new to all of it, but then directorially, he gives you a lot of license. He lets you play, he lets you do some, you know, whatever the fuck you want, really. It's specific, but
he's a collaborator.
He is a collaborator, folks. You can feel it.
Okay,
well, Casey, do you have any other dream roles within the canon of BJJ?
Wow.
that you can think of.
I don't honestly think that there are any roles for me other than the one I played, or maybe something in Neighbors. Because Gloria, I don't think, has one for me. Unless the person, because the production I saw, there was, I want to say, an Asian woman. And I don't know, I can't remember if that was specific or not, or if or if that could just be a woman of color, but is she specifically Asian?
That's like the first choice that was behind her character description. I only know because I just started reading it yesterday.
Yeah. And appropriate is all white people.
Everybody,
so I don't know.
I guess you could.
Oh, everybody. Yeah, everybody. I was actually going to audition for the production of Everybody that they just did here, but I was.
Did you see that one?
I did see that one.
All right, we'll talk about it on the episode. Yeah. That's exciting. Because I'm sad I didn't get to see it either.
Yeah.
Okay, well, cool. Just wondering, because that's something we do at the end of the miniseries, but since you won't be here then, I want to make sure that we...
I think I might go to Chicago to see Purpose. Ooh. And so we'll see. Maybe there will be a future dream role.
We should do a pod... road trip and go see it too.
Yeah,
I want to go to Chicago and see the Sufjan Stevens show. Let's go.
There's a lot of stuff to do. Chicago Theater, shout out. We love you. We don't talk about you.
I love Chicago Theater so much.
Cool. Let's spotlight some LA theater real quick.
LA Spotlight.
I'll go first. A New Brain, Celebration Theater at the LGBT Center. I am so fucking stoked for this show. April 29th through June 24th. Go to celebrationtheaterre.org or at celebrationtheater, THTR, at Instagram. Also, One Acts Somewhere is returning Friday, April 29th, Friday the 28th, Saturday the 29th. We'll put the hashtags in the bio. There's 4 brand new plays, and it's at 7 o'clock both those nights. It was sold out last time, so it was a lot of fun. There's going to be free barbecue and parking also.
Nice. Awesome.
Scott, you got any?
Yeah, I've got 3 new plays. Colonialism is Terrible, but Faux is Delicious is getting great reviews. It's running through April 30th at the Chance Theater. Okay. Chance Theater always does
all
cool
right,
stuff.
Chance.
Checks out chancetheater.com.
I've told you this, though, at the Chance Theater. I had to go back for 3 callbacks one time. Oh, right. I didn't book it. And every time I went back, I knew I wasn't going to get it. Like, I could feel it in the room because there was a guy who had been in like 10 shows there. And I was like, I'm never going to get this. Why do you keep calling me back? So I'm always a little bitter about the Chance Theater, but we love you, Chance.
I thought that was going to happen to me for Gifted. I don't know if Rebecca told me that story. But I was like, there's no way they're casting me. And they brought me back 3 times and I was pissed.
You were like number one from the jet. I was in the
room. I read with you at your audition and I was like, Casey's got it. Casey's gonna play the lead. I knew it, and I was just there for the.
No offense to anybody who
they had a white lady on the poster. So I was like, there's no way I'm gonna book this.
Well, they changed the fucking poster.
Fuck the poster.
Fuck the poster.
But I was in the room as well for your audition, Casey, and you walked out, and Rebecca and I looked at each other, and whoever the other producer was looked at each other, and we were like, okay, well, cool. We can look for the other characters now. Like, you had it from the beginning, as you do for everything. But I want to shout out this show that I will be seeing called I Sell Windows. The one-woman show, one night only in Los Angeles at the Greenway Court Theater, written and performed by Casey Rogers. Who directed it?
Jaquita Tale.
Amazing.
Yes.
Cool. So you can get tickets. We'll put the link in the bio. It's on the 21st at 8 p.m. April 21st at 8 p.m.
Yeah, get your tickets right now because I heard. So I'm performing this as a part of the Jam Festival that Greenway Court does every year. Cool. It is a hip hop and poetry festival, and I was lucky enough to be one of the first actual plays that they're allowing to be in the festival. There's me, and there's another performer. Their name is Theo, represented by Celebration Theater, who are going to be performing our pieces throughout this time. But a little birdie told me that my show is the best-selling show of the entire festival.
Well-deserved.
Well-deserved.
There's not a ton of tickets left, so please, please, please get your tickets while they last. We would love to have you in the room.
Hell yeah. And obviously, go check out Casey's Instagram, which we'll have in the bio as well. And I'll also put a link to the Blackboard Collective because it's something that I really loved and have been following. Is there anything else you want to shout out?
No, I think that's it for me. Thank you so much for having me, you guys.
Oh,
this was
so
much
fun. Thank you
for joining us,
Casey. Much. Yeah, we'll have to have you back
super,
for sure.
Super appreciate you. We'll definitely get you back on for something else. Maybe this season, if you're free for it.
Yeah.
We'll pick a movie and
we'll
watch it. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Let's do it.
Cool, y'all. Well, let's get out of here. Thank you for joining us for part one of three of our Brandon Jacobs Jenkins miniseries, A Podcast Rune. Is that what we're calling it?
I like that. A podcast rune?
I think that's where we're going with. Or is it Ann Podcast Rune? Like, keep the
it's
A-N.
It's Ann. Yeah, that's Ann.
The sweatier, the bettier.
Yeah, you're right. gross. Ann Podcast Rune is our miniseries, so check out that art. It's probably really great. but yeah, we'll see you next time. Oh, wait. Next time, we're covering Gloria with special guest Teddy Trice. Someone we've done an artist spotlight with, but we haven't actually had on the pod, and we've been waiting to get him on for a long time. He's in an off-Broadway show right now in New York. He did Book of Mormon on Broadway for a while, and he's just been doing the whole bit. So we're having Teddy Trice on. That's going to be incredible. And then the next week, we're having Casper on for everybody. And that will be an absolute blast. Join us for those. I don't remember what we're doing after that. Is it clowning?
Yes, we are with Bonnie Hee.
Clowning with Bonnie Hee. So we have guests up the butt awesome for the next guests. 3 weeks. We're very excited.
Or up the mouth.
Oh, same thing.
Yeah, same thing.
So that's all I got. See you later.
Do y'all have questions or comments? You can reach out to us via email, Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song's better than your theme song.
Bitch.
That's true.
He also writes all of our stingers. He's an amazing human being. We love him. And finally, to the award-winning playwright Carol Churchill, who writes every single one of our episodes and doesn't even know it. And one day, Carol Churchill, we're going to buy you a beer. Or some sort of cocktail.
Yes.
That's exactly right.
Rate, review.
Oh, subscribe. Rate, review. Thank you, Casey.
I used to forget that every time on my podcast, too. I was like, what is it? Like, rate, subscribe, share.
Rate, subscribe, share. Do the thing. It helps a lot. We appreciate you. And thanks, Casey.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you
awesome
so much.
Awesome having you.
See you guys next time.
Bye.
Dance, magic, put that baby spell on me. Slap that baby, make him pee.
Why are we slapping babies?
You're right, I don't know.
Later, everybody.
Goodbye.
The theater. Bring out Louis!
Theater.
Theater.